Hello, and welcome to One-on-One with Robert Doerr. I'm your host, Robert Doerr, and thanks for tuning in today. As president of the American Enterprise Institute, I have the unique privilege of working with America's greatest policy experts. These scholars focus on policy issues in the fields of education, economics, energy, foreign and defense, and so much more. Subscribe to this podcast for exclusive access to in-depth discussions on the most pressing policy issues. Together with my guests, we'll challenge political preconceptions, explore innovative ideas, and create, I hope, a freer and safer world. Hello, everyone, and welcome to One-on-One with Robert Doerr. I have as a terrific guest today Michael Strain, the Director of Economics Policy at the American Enterprise Institute. And it's a great pleasure to have Michael. Michael's quite happy today because inflation numbers came out. And they
nothing makes me happier than when the purchasing power of the wages of the American worker are diminished.
Well, I shouldn't have said you were happy. You were happy because your prediction, which you only wrote about a week earlier, that this idea of a soft landing was a little premature and that it was likely that inflation was not yet dead, has been borne out. Or am I wrong?
No, you are right. I think we did not need those numbers to come to that conclusion. If you look at the labor market, if you look at overall economic output, if you look at the inflation data that we had prior to the release of the February CPI data, I think it was clear that the economy had not achieved a soft landing, despite all the celebrating by many economists and commentators and others. But certainly the CPI data we had this morning make that even more clear.
But you would acknowledge that the absence of a soft landing to Americans is borne out in higher prices. That's what's bothering them. That's what's not soft about the current economy. The hot labor market feels good to them, doesn't it?
I think it depends on who you're talking about. So maybe we should step back. What do we mean by soft landing? I think we mean basically three things. First, a situation in which the economy's underlying rate of inflation is roughly where the Fed wants it to be for a relatively significant period of time. Secondly, that the labor market is hot enough to be adding jobs and tight enough to have relatively low unemployment, but not so hot and not so tight that it is contributing to inflationary pressure. And number three, that overall growth in economic output, GDP growth, is fast enough that the economy is growing, but not so fast that economic growth is adding materially to inflationary pressure. And so I think the point that you're making about the labor market is a very good one. We, in our enthusiasm to have inflation return to the Fed's target, we should not be rooting for unnecessary job loss. We should not be rooting for high unemployment. One of the many things we share is that we love employment and we love low unemployment rates. But there is such a thing as too low, and the reason too low is problematic is that it leads to higher interest rates, it leads to higher price inflation. Those higher interest rates can cause recessions, and that higher price inflation can erode the purchasing power of the wages that workers are earning.
Well, let's talk about the Fed's target. It's 2%. Right now, it's closer to 3%. What's wrong with 3%?
Well, there's nothing magic about 2%. The Fed decided to adopt an explicit inflation target, and there were a number of decisions that could have been made. 1.5%, I think, was on the table. 2.5% was on the table. The Fed went with 2. The idea is to have enough inflation that you can kind of lubricate the machinery of the economy, but to have inflation be low enough that it's in the background, it's not driving decisions, low enough that you don't see unions demanding multi-year COLAs, low enough that it's not influencing wage-setting behavior, low enough that suppliers aren't demanding, you know, multi-year contracts with escalating prices, things of that nature. I think it was a mistake to set an explicit target, but that is a mistake that the Fed made, and the Fed made it decades ago, and to abandon the...
Yeah, you're kind of a Fed credibility guy. If you say you're going to do it, you should do it.
I think the lesson, so, you know, where does inflation come from? Why do we have inflation? That is a question that economists don't have a good enough answer to. I think economists don't adequately understand inflation and inflation dynamics. But I think one of the things that economists have learned in recent decades is that inflation has a large psychological component to it, and that inflation today, the extent to which businesses are raising prices today, is really driven in large part by the expectations that businesses have about inflation in the future. And businesses tie their expectations about inflation in the future to what the Fed says it's going to do, which is to keep inflation at 2%. The Fed has been remarkably successful at anchoring expectations at 2%, to the point where, you know, we were able to do massive quantitative easing programs following both the financial crisis of 2008 and the pandemic. We were able to keep interest rates at or near 0% over the short run for years and years and years, without inflation expectations becoming de-anchored. So yes, I think if the Fed were to say, you know, certainly if it were to explicitly say, you know, our preferred measure of inflation is, you know, running at about 2.5%, you know, we're probably a 2.8% inflation economy, and we think that's close enough. You know, I think that that would run the risk of inflation expectations becoming delinked from the Fed's inflation
target.
It's
all about what you expect to happen. It's how you make investment decisions. It's
yeah.
How you decide how much to borrow, how much not to borrow,
that's
how much
right.
to invest.
And then this
you want those expectations to be grounded in something that you can rely on.
You do, and you want that for the concrete, tangible reason that that is good for workers. If we went back to a regime like we had in the 1970s, where suppliers are escalating the prices they're charging, where unions are building out automatic escalations in labor costs, and where inflation really gets out of control, that's bad for workers. That's bad for typical workers. That's bad for typical households, because a high inflation environment sees the erosion of the purchasing power of wages and incomes in a way that the inflationary environment we've enjoyed for decades does not.
Okay, so one more question on this. There's some time on this, but the coverage that I saw when this news of a little uptick in inflation had the headline, and this might have been wishful thinking, is a little bit higher inflation, but rate cut plan not altered.
Mm-hmm.
Fed's sort of expected to cut rates in June, I think, and the first headline said that's probably not changed. Don't you think it should be changed, given that inflation is clearly still with us?
Yeah, I think you know, the bond market was a little confused by the inflation data. You saw short-term yields jump, then you saw them retreat, then you saw them jump again, and you could see the bond market trying to figure out what was in the report in real time. I think the story of 2024 is going to be a story of the market adjusting down the number of rate cuts we're going to have. there was
they've already done a lot of adjusting. Yeah.
There was a time not too long ago when when many people and when the market as a whole expected the first rate cuts would come this month in March, in January and February of this year, there were economists who were saying, you know, why are we waiting until March? I think the market now, the last time I looked, placed a 1% chance of a rate cut at the Fed's March meeting. The last time I looked a few hours ago, the market still expected that the Fed would cut in June. I don't expect a June rate cut. I think what we learned is that CPI inflation has re-entered a period where its trend is accelerating. We are now in an economy with upward trending CPI inflation. I don't think we knew that before this morning, but I think that's what we learned. That's a big shift.
Yeah.
And now we still don't have upward trending PCE inflation, which is what the Fed cares the most about, and we don't have upward trending wage inflation. And we also don't have upward trending producer price inflation. And so the Fed will look at a variety of indicators when assessing when to cut rates. But it is hard to imagine the economy deteriorating, the economy softening enough over the course of the next 3 months for the Fed to cut rates in June.
So this must all come as a little bit of a surprise to you, notwithstanding your short-term predictions, because, you know, the Fed's has been in a long-term rate rising trend, up, 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 till the level we've reached. And members of your profession, your world, have this phrase about the effects of rising interest rate have long lags and
long and variable lags.
Long and variable lags. And my understanding is you and many other economists predicted this higher interest rates would have brought this economy down. How do you explain the underlying strength of the American economy? Why is it so strong after these pretty significant rate increases that started now some time ago?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I expected that the economy would enter recession in 2023, and it did not. And I can tell you one thing that I got wrong for sure, and I can tell you a second thing that I may have gotten wrong that I'm less sure about. So the big thing
and you weren't alone.
Well, I was not alone. No. I was in good company. I think the big thing that I didn't anticipate was the voracious appetite of the American consumer to spend money. Go back to 2020 when the pandemic first hit. Congress appropriately engaged in a historically unprecedented, massive campaign of support for American workers, households, and businesses, and that continued into 2021. I think inadvisably, but nonetheless, it happened. And so households were sitting on a massive pile of money, and I expected that they would spend that money down, and I expected that would create, you know, quite strong economic demand in 2021 and in 2022, and I expected that would lead to inflation, and that is in fact what happened. Then I kind of thought households would stop, you know, but households drove the savings rate lower than it had been in 2019. And so households, you know, not only spent all the money they had from you know, the combination of fiscal policy support and just not spending as much money in 2020 because they weren't going out into the world as much. Not only did they spend that pile of money, but they actually engaged in consumption behavior that was systematically different than in 2019. They saved a lot less than they had before the pandemic. I thought, okay, well, you know, revenge spending is a real thing. You know, people have been cooped up in their houses. I'm going to go on that vacation. I don't care if, you know, the price of an airline ticket is 30% higher than it used to be. I'm going to stay in that hotel. I don't care if rates are higher. I'm going to go out to dinner more often, et cetera, et cetera. Then they started running up credit card debt. And, you know, I thought to myself, okay, well, you know, households are really seeing their levels of credit card debt increase. You know, that's going to put a stop to this. It didn't. Now we know that credit card delinquency rates are higher than they were prior to the pandemic. That's going to put a stop to this consumer spending binge. That hasn't. We now know, at least according to some private sector data sources, that the share of households tapping into their 401ks to finance consumption is way higher than it was before the pandemic. That surprises me. That's not something that I expected.
Although I would point out that I read that story. It's still only, I think it's less than 5% of households tap. So it's not, when you first read the headline, you think, oh my God, people in great rates are tapping into their 401ks, but it's really a tiny fraction. It's much higher than it's been in the past, but it's small.
Yeah, sure, for sure. But it's indicative of this kind of, you know, it's indicative, I think, of the strength of the appetite. You know, people, the people who are tapping into this, they're not tapping into it because they would be destitute without that money. They're tapping into it for, you know, what we would think of as kind of more routine, discretionary spending activities. And so, you know, that has been surprising. That has to come to an end at some point. The retail sales data for the month of January were quite negative. And we'll learn what happened in February later this week. We'll see if that is, you know, was January a one-off or is January the start of a trend. But the broader point is that consumption spending
has driven
which is
this.
much stronger, I think, than
why don't you say government spending and government stimulus has been much stronger? Hasn't that also been true?
Well, that's definitely been part of it for sure. But the engine behind the economy in 2023 really was the consumer, and you know, much more so, I think, than forecasters thought, kind of heading into 2023.
So let's talk about something that might bring prices down a little, and I read about it, and I want you to tell us.
But I can
us.
Tell you the other thing I got, I may have gotten wrong, too.
What else did you get wrong?
Well, we think, you know, so right now, the federal funds rate is, you know, 5 3/8. And we think of that as very high. It's certainly high relative to recent history when it's mostly been zero. The Fed thinks that a federal funds rate of 250 basis points is neutral, that interest rate does not create a tailwind or a headwind for the economy. I would have said a month ago that the Fed was lowballing that by, you know, 50 or 100 basis points. I'm starting to question whether even that is too low, and whether or not a lesson that we will learn in 2024 is that, you know, 5 3/8 just isn't really that high. And
by the way, for a long period in a post-war period, it wasn't very high. It was a reasonable amount, and the economy grew at those rates for a long time. Isn't that correct?
Sure.
And when I think of myself as a lender, if I'm going to lend you money, the idea that I wouldn't get at least 5% back is preposterous.
So we're talking about so we're not talking about for mortgages.
No, I know we're not talking about mortgages, talking about but any kind of giving of money. Zero interest rate is almost doesn't make any sense to me.
And yet that's what we've been living with.
So maybe we've learned that was a really strange period and we're getting back to normal at a higher neutral rate of interest.
Maybe.
Okay.
I think the jury's still out on that one.
Oh, all right.
But if so, that would explain some things.
it would mean that these high interest rates aren't as effective at slowing the economy down because the neutral rate is higher.
Because they're not that high.
Yeah.
Because it turns out they're not that high.
Yeah. Okay. Sometimes I read in the paper that the one countervailing force on all this inflation and prices and price increases is a surplus of products, especially cars in China, and that notwithstanding whatever tariffs we have, that they're going to come flooding into Western markets and drive prices down. Is that true? Do I have that right, or is that completely wrong?
Well, when we talk about inflation, we talk about changes in the overall level of prices in the economy. So in any given month, the price of some goods and services go up a lot. In any given month, the price of some goods and services fall quite a bit. That's normal in a economy as large and dynamic as ours. The price of some goods going up and some services going up is not itself indicative of inflation. This comes up a lot in discussions of tariffs. And so President Trump is proposing, or I don't know, proposing maybe too strong a verb. President Trump is musing about substantially increasing tariff rates on Chinese imports, and maybe more broadly than that. That would lead to higher prices for imported goods, the goods that can't escape the tariff. It would lead to higher prices of domestically produced goods that use imports as an input to production. It probably wouldn't lead to more inflation. It probably wouldn't lead the general price level in the economy to rise more rapidly, but it would, lead to price spikes for some things.
So again, in other words, the tariffs may prevent a flooding of low cost goods into the American economy.
Tariffs can be effective to stop dumping.
Okay. You did write something the other day. The headline was "Trump-Biden consensus on the economy is bad for business." And then, of course, the shocker in that is that you're saying the Trump-Biden consensus, they have similar economic policies. Mm-hmm. In what way are their economic policies similar?
Well, I think their economic policies are similar in many ways. I mean, they're both really driven by the populist turn in American politics. Both President Trump and President Biden have a special affinity for the manufacturing sector and want to give the manufacturing sector special treatment, want to boost manufacturing employment as a goal of economic policy. They kind of want to, go about it in similar ways. President Trump, I think, is more fond of tariffs than President Biden, and wanted to achieve that goal through a tariff regime. And to the surprise of many, President Biden kept that tariff regime largely in place. President Biden is more interested than President Trump in achieving that goal using industrial subsidies. That's, I think, in part because he has other goals that he wants to use subsidies for. He wants to spark a green tech revolution in the United States, and kind of use this as a twofer. We can boost manufacturing employment, we can revitalize the manufacturing sector, and we can spark a green revolution with hundreds of billions of dollars of subsidies for green tech. I think both President Trump and President Biden agree that we should be subsidizing the production of semiconductors in the United States, particularly in swing states in the 2024 presidential election, which tells you something about the motivation behind those subsidies. Neither is particularly
well. So they're both protectionists. They're both industrial policy proponents, and they're both big spenders. Isn't that really the summary of it? They're all three of those things.
They are all three of those things. I mean, I would extend it, you know, even further. Neither seem, you know, particularly interested in championing personal responsibility. Neither of them seem to have a very high opinion of the ability of American workers and businesses of being able to succeed and compete on their own. Both seem to want to, you know, kind of infantilize the American worker and American businesses. You know, President Trump says, you know, this is broken and I alone can fix it. President Biden has less of an authoritarian flavor to it, but says, you know, this is broke and only big government can fix it. That is a...
They're basically the same thing.
Well, they're quite similar. And that's a really striking departure from presidents of both parties in the recent past. I think they're both less welcoming of immigrants. They are both.
Slow down there. Biden has a broken immigration system. There's mm-hmm. no question. And immigrants are flooding into the United States. There's a lot of data mm-hmm. that shows the number of immigrants coming to the United States in the last couple of years has grown dramatically.
Way up.
And what I wanted to talk about was whether that was all bad or just some bad and some good.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll do that in a minute. But I would never call Biden to be less welcoming of immigrants in the way that Trump is. Did you really mean to say that?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think it would be hard to be... it would be hard to be less welcoming of immigrants than President Trump. You know, President Trump is openly hostile to immigrants and demonizes immigrants and is promising the largest deportation campaign in American history if he's elected. You know, he's essentially hanging a sign on the Statue of Liberty saying immigrants aren't welcome here.
That's one way of seeing it. Biden's not doing any of those things.
Biden is not doing any of those things, but I think Biden has been less pro-immigration than many expected. I think in part that's because the border is such a huge mess.
Yeah.
But I think if you look at some of the early actions he took around refugees, for example, before the border became known to be the crisis it currently is.
So acknowledging there's a crisis and there's a breakdown of the rule of law, there's also big numbers of people coming in and sort of disappearing into the mammoth American economy. And what I want to ask you is the honest looking at the data is that leaving aside, you know, specific examples of crime or fentanyl or things like that and welfare usage. But overall, is even that these last 2 years actually contributed to growth for the United States?
Oh, I think there's no question but that it's contributed to economic growth. And I also think there's no question that it's contributed to a cooling of wage inflation, which has been helpful from a macroeconomic perspective. There are two ways to get your economy to grow. One way is to make your existing workers more productive, and the second way is to increase the rate at which your workforce is growing. And immigration is a great way to do both.
So, turning to another thing that you wrote recently, you turned your attention in a column to the Russian reserves being seized and being deployed in humanitarian aid or some other kind of aid to Ukraine. I thought when I spoke to you about this some time ago that you were cautious on this. You were concerned mm-hmm. that in a world economy, to say to people with money who make investments because of a geopolitical conflict, you're going to take their money and seize it and take it away, it would be destabilizing and probably not the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But have you flipped on that in this case? Is that what's happened?
I've come around on this. You know, it's a complicated question. There are you know, legal issues, and I'm certainly not a international lawyer. There are questions. There are economic issues associated with this. There's also, you know, I think precedence issues. is this a tactic that we really want on the table going forward? But I think the case for it is growing every month. That Ukraine needs the money. And in a very practical sense, who's going to pay for that?
Who should pay for it?
Should the U.S. taxpayer pay for it? Should taxpayers in European nations pay for it? Or should Ukrainians pay for it? Or should Russia be at the front of the line to pay for it?
Who's responsible for it?
And that's a very practical, common sense argument that that I think is pretty compelling. I think you're hearing some strange ideas that are kind of latching on to this. Let's take the Russian central bank assets that are in Western financial institutions and give some of them for economic development in the third world, or give some of them to other entities. That sort of nonsense is a reason to be cautious about doing something like this. I'm not sure what the legal or moral basis for that would be. But the kind of, straight down the middle, let's figure out how to get this money to Ukraine. Let's figure out how to create institutions that decide how we're going to do that. Let's figure out how to create institutions that decide which reconstruction and rebuilding projects take priority. But let's make sure that every penny of this goes to Ukraine. That the case for that, I think, is pretty compelling.
Okay, so I have one big, large question, and then I have some speed questions, which you have to answer yes or no.
We're going to do a lightning round.
So let's do the large question first, which is, I have had sensed in listening to you and reading you that there are aspects of the strong China hawk policy that makes you uncomfortable. And so I guess, and I think it's because you want to preserve a mutually beneficial trading relationship with the second largest economy in the world. So to give me an example of the sort of thing you don't want to see happen that would preserve that trade relationship for the benefit of both Americans and Chinese.
I think that there is a lot of heat and confusion around this issue. And I think it's important to be clear about objectives. The bilateral trade deficit with China is not an economic problem. Whether or not Americans purchase shampoo, children's toys, socks, and underwear from China does not pose a national security threat to the United States. On the other hand, imagine that every American had to take a pill every morning, or they would suffer a serious health ailment. Would you want that pill to be produced in Taiwan or in Beijing? Of course you wouldn't. And so there are, I think, some items that can be specifically enumerated and that could make up a small list that we should be concerned about being manufactured in or near China. But it is a huge leap from that observation to the observation that those items should be manufactured in swing states in the 2024 presidential election, or that having those items manufactured outside of Taiwan or outside of China has anything at all to do with revitalizing America's domestic manufacturing base. And so, some basic clarity of thought, some basic clarity of objectives, I think, would help this policy debate quite a bit. I also think thinking through some of the practical ramifications of policies that are suggested would be helpful. Do we really want to say, nations don't trade with each other. Individuals and businesses in nations trade with individuals and businesses in other nations. Do we really want to say that no American individual or corporation should be allowed to purchase items manufactured in China. Do we really want to say that no American individual or business should be able to invest in any Chinese entity? Imagine the economic police state that would be required to enforce such a policy. America is a free society with economic liberty, and we would be sacrificing that to a giant regulatory bureaucracy if we were to actually try and proceed with those types of policies.
So there are opportunities to purchase products that are not of a national security importance from China that keep prices for Americans lower, and we shouldn't be afraid to pursue those. And there are also opportunities for investors and, I presume, exporters to sell products or invest in things in China that could be good for Americans, and we shouldn't shut all of that off unilaterally. That's your point.
Yes. I mean, I would go even further than that, but that is one of my points.
Okay.
The confusion around this issue, I mean, extends, you know, you mentioned exports. I think most people who follow this debate reasonably closely would come away from it thinking that trade with China has cost Americans jobs. The best estimate for the net employment effect of trade with China over the past three decades is zero. Zero jobs gained, zero jobs lost. When you trade with somebody, you import and export. And that has been happening in the United States.
But not just zero jobs gained, zero jobs lost, but also some contribution to growth.
Higher productivity for American workers, higher wages for American workers, higher incomes for American households, and wages and incomes that go further because consumer prices are lower.
Okay. I'm glad you gave us that
position. I mean, we could keep going.
Okay. So now the hard part.
The
lightning.
You don't want to keep going.
We've had a good conversation.
But now we're leaving that subject.
We're leaving that subject. I mean, is there something I left out? You want to add more?
I'm happy to move to the lightning round.
Okay. So, this is a, looks like the leading candidates from the two parties are going to be the candidates for president that we all consider in November. President Biden on one side, former President Trump on the other.
That's what it looks like.
Now, we can talk about their characters and their age and their rhetoric and their leadership qualities all we want, but you're the economist and you're the economic policies expert. So I'm going to ask you on a couple of economic policy issues, not what they're going to be, but judging the Biden administration to date and the Trump administration's 4 years, which policy was better? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's take climate policy.
Climate policy.
Climate policy as it affects the economy. Which, climate policy becoming an economic
which
policy.
Which administration had a better climate policy?
Yes.
Trump.
Okay. So now let's take trade policy.
Tie.
Fiscal policy.
Trump.
China
Does
policy.
Fiscal policy includes tax policy.
Yes, taxes and,
taxes
and spending.
Taxes, Trump.
China policy.
Biden.
So overall economic policy.
Overall economic policy is better? Yeah. Trump. I would also, can I add one? I think the CARES Act, which President Trump signed into law in March of 2020, will be remembered in history as one of the best, most important laws to combat an economic crisis that we've ever had. And I think the American Rescue Plan signed by President Biden in the spring of 2021 will be remembered as one of the greatest fiscal policy mistakes in the last half century. And so this wasn't one of your categories, but I would add pandemic policy as well.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Michael. This has been a great conversation. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.